If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, I'm Matt Kelly.
And I'm Matt D'Ancona.
And this is the Two Mats for the week ending Friday, the 23rd of November. Two men searching not for the answer, but merely the outline of an answer.
It's a quest. It's a journey,
isn't it? It is a journey.
In a very real sense.
What are we going to call this episode? What do we talk about?
We talked about... it's been a real populist week. We talked about Nigel in the jungle, and we talked about Geert Wilders, and we talked about Milei in Argentina.
And how to spot a fascist.
How to spot a fascist. That's very good.
That's podcast clickbait, isn't
that's,
it? In a good way.
How to listen to me.
Because we're not lying. We do actually tell you
how to spot a fascist. We give detailed
14 ways
we
to
give
spot a fascist.
Detailed blueprint.
We do. Okay, so there we have it. So this is the Two Mats, episode 23, How to Spot a Fascist.
Enjoy.
So, Matt, what are we talking about this week?
Well, I think this week we have to talk about the week in populism, because there's been a lot of it. The first and obvious subject is Nigel Farage in the jungle.
Yeah.
I'm a celebrity, get me out of here. And we're recording this on Thursday, and on last night's show, Wednesday's show, things went postal with Nella Rose, the YouTuber.
Never heard of Nella Rose, but...
You've heard of her now.
Can you play a clip?
But this is what I was saying to you.
Because apparently you're anti-immigrants.
And
you're,
who told you that?
The internet.
There we are then. It must be true.
Okay, but then why don't black people like you?
You'd be amazed they do.
If you came with me
through South London, you'd be astonished.
Oh, wow. What were you doing in South London, Nigel?
Well, I'm there every day.
You're in South. I'm so sorry to be shy. What are you doing? Sorry.
He's from South London.
I travel through South London.
So everyone hates you for no reason. Well, not that everyone hates you. That was so bad.
You can disagree with somebody, but to chuck around accusations the way that they've been chucked around is grossly unfair. Anti-immigrant, right? No. All I've said is we cannot go on with the numbers coming to Britain that are coming. Do you know why?
I'm one of the numbers.
Oh, right. So that's it then. So should it be 5 million a year? 10 million?
Question.
No,
right?
You don't seem to understand.
Nigel, hang on.
Those immigrants that are coming in.
Hang on.
Had you been in power a bit later, think about immigrants. I did not expect to be caught in a full-on debate. I really didn't. Just wanted a bubble bath.
That was Danielle Harrell, I think, the EastEnders star.
Who I'd never heard
not,
of.
Not known to
I'm
me,
afraid.
But that was a great line.
I think she summed up the last 7 years for a lot of people.
Basically, really landed it. And then Nella said of Farage, he's wrong and strong, which I think, unfortunately, he'll rather like.
Yeah, but I thought we saw a glimpse of... I know we both kind of think Farage is going to do really well in this because he's good at playing people, blah, blah, blah. But you've got a glimpse there of the patronising, hectoring Farage.
Well, he can't help talking like a TV host,
And
it really, I thought she reacted well.
He goes on after that. After that clip ended, he goes on saying, she says, well, I don't agree with you. He said, well, you're not listening to me then, are you? Have you heard a word I've said? You know,
yes.
I mean, it's kind of rather bizarre behaviour, I thought.
But. And he's not making any bones about why he's doing it, he said that in one of, I think he was in the diary room, whatever they call it, you know, about the Tory leadership, he said, well, I'll never say never. A little too, obviously.
And 1.5 million smackers comes in handy, I guess.
Yes, and also if you get 80 to 90,000 viewers for your show on GB News, and, you know, apparently it's not doing as well as they'd hoped that so far.
Do you think that's to do with him?
I don't know. It's really interesting. But still, they're getting 7 to 8 million viewers. So for him, it's
big.
It's all win. But it does come back, doesn't it? And it's a subject we've talked about a fair bit on the pod, you know, which is this kind of weird convergence of politics and entertainment, particularly on the sort of populist right-wing side. And, you know, look what's happened in the Netherlands.
Well, this is, I mean, from the sublime to the ridiculous, to the unsublime. Geert Wilders. How do you say Geert?
I think Geert Wilders.
Wilders. But like a guy who is basically a full-on fascist.
Yeah, he is openly anti-Islamic, wants the Quran banned, wants no new mosques, talks about Eurabia, which is trigger word in the far right world. I mean, what's scary about him is that he's been going at it for so long, and now he's finally past the threshold he'll have difficulty forming a coalition. But, you know, he looks like he's going to be the next prime minister of the Netherlands.
Which is incredibly worrying. And we should talk about the sort of political consequences of that at some point. But I just used a word there, which people throw around very wildly these days, the word fascist.
Yeah.
And if you use it on Twitter, quite rightly, a lot of people will come back at you and say, oh, everyone I don't like's a fascist, you know, and all of this business. And we once did a front page on the New European about, God, it must have been at the beginning of Trump's presidency, and we had a picture of Trump's head, and we put the barcode of the newspaper on his upper lip like a little Hitler moustache, and it looked very funny. And the headline was, is Trump a fascist? And I went on Any Questions that week, and this front page was raised.
Right.
The great Mary Beard phoned in, onto Any Questions, and said, would Matt Kelly care to explain what he means by fascist?
Right.
And it stumped me. And it's one of these words that we all have a sense of what it means.
Yes.
And you can point to certain figures in history and say, well, that's a fascist. But what does it mean more broadly? And so I did a bit of research, chastened by Mary Beard. I did some research. And the best thing I came across was an essay written by Umberto Eco in 1995, where he lists 14 characteristics of a fascist.
Well, let's have them.
And he does it in a way as to be useful so that people can tick them off.
A checklist.
A checklist for, is someone a fascist?
Well, I think we need that.
Now, I will say there's 14 of them, but I think it's fascinating when you go through them one by one. So the first one, the cult of tradition.
Yep.
You know, pointing to the past and saying, this is how we've always done things, you know, and this is how things should be.
Yes.
You know, that sentiment. The second one is a rejection of modernism, you know, again, tied into that tradition, but saying that these new ideas are somehow wrong and are corrosive and the enemy. That disagreement is treason, right? This is central to the idea of fascism. They cannot...
Enemies of the people, judges.
How many times have we seen this?
So often.
Fear of difference, okay? Central, again, to how people perceive...
Suella Braverman and hurricanes of...
Stop the
migrants,
boats.
Invasions.
But our villages are changing. Yes. Polish delis, blah, 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 all of this stuff. I thought this one was fascinating. And I nearly left this one out because I thought, well, gosh, that's hard to say. But I think it's the biggest example that we can talk about. Action for action's sake. And I think Brexit. You know, it's let's leave the European Union.
Well, it's performative politics, isn't it?
Performative politics.
Gesture politics all
the
time.
You know, all of this stuff. Appeal to social frustration. See
well,
that
that's
all the
straight
time.
Down the line.
Obsession with a plot. Hello, Daily Mail.
Yes.
You know, absolute playbook. This one's fascinating. The enemy is both weak and strong at the same time.
Oh, that's very good.
We see that all the time, don't we?
Yes.
You know,
contempt for the enemy who's going to destroy us.
That's right. That's right. That's right.
Yes. You know, contempt for the blob, which is going to destroy us. Contempt for the wokerati, who are going to destroy us.
Who are all going to destroy us.
Yes.
Pacifism, But pacifism is trafficking with the enemies in, and this sense that everything is a struggle.
Yes.
You know, that life is a struggle.
Everything is bellicose and warlike.
Exactly. Contempt for the weak. You see that
well,
all
that's
the time.
Straight through.
Machismo and weaponry as identifiers. You know, this sense that the state has to be strong, the strong man.
Yes.
And do it, you know.
Strong leadership.
Very masculine sense,
yes.
You know, and an obsession with power,
yep.
as an end to itself, you know.
Potency, just
potency,
showing, yeah,
that's
yeah.
the word. It's potency yes. in quite a sort of
virility.
Yes,
yeah.
exactly. In almost like a literal kind
yeah.
of. And we see that in, you know, in Trump, the way they put it, Bolsonaro, the way our friend in Argentina.
Yes, who we'll speak about in a minute.
Yeah. Selective populism. Right now, here is the direct quote from Umberto Eco's essay. Get a load of this. That the emotional response of a group of citizens can be presented as the voice of the people.
Well, I mean, we had that, for example, as justification for both the prorogation of Parliament, which was into 2019, which was ruled unlawful, and for the 2019 election. You know, the people's will is being frustrated.
And also just the total negation of any idea that Brexit should be looked at again in the future, because the people have spoken.
The people have spoken, and more to the point, I, Boris Johnson, or whoever it is, speak for the people.
Yeah.
You know, they are the spokesperson
that's right.
of the people.
And
you know?
They that group of people who suit me at this time are the people.
Selective is very clever as well, because it's absolutely right.
And the last one, which I hope this podcast is part of negating, is a tendency to speak in newspeak, as Umberto Eco called it. I think he would call it tweets these days.
Yes.
Brief, concise messages that don't allow for more considered opinion.
Well,
thought.
I mean, get Brexit done.
Yeah.
You know, stop the boats, all these things. You know, they are. I mean, I think long-term decisions for a brighter future has kind of jumped the shark. It's absolutely true. And I mean, Dominic Cummings, for all his flaws, was a master of just boiling down, you know, like a stock, these messages to three, hopefully, you know, monosyllabic words.
I think I might have mentioned this, but you know how. Actually, it wasn't Cummings who came up with the slogan of slogans, take back control. It was Paul McKenna, the Tory-leaning hypnotist who helped hypnotize an entire nation.
Taking back control quite a lot.
You know,
that is really interesting.
This onion is an apple.
I have to say that it's a pretty good list.
I mean, and what struck me as curious, and maybe this is something where we need to be careful about when we bandy words like fascist about, is just how many of those criteria now apply to the hard left as well, though.
Oh, yes. I mean, it's not confined to the right. However, this week it is.
Yeah.
And you mentioned Argentina, where a politician who's actually only been a member of Congress in Argentina since 2021, called Javier Milei, has been elected president. And we were talking in the most recent Q&A about the use of words like mad and bonkers and crazy. Mm-hmm. Well, this guy is called El Loco in Argentina. I mean, and also plays on his, I think, performative craziness.
He brought out a chainsaw while he was campaigning.
He brings out a chainsaw in order to talk about, because he describes himself as an anarcho-capitalist. He's one of these populists who believe, and not all populists are the same. Some populists are protectionists and want to grow the government and all that stuff. But this guy, he wants to tear the state to pieces. And he, as you say, carried a chainsaw around with him, which is not normal behavior for a prospective head of government. Anyway, you know, he's now won. The more you look into him, I mean, his hair makes Boris Johnson look like a Sandhurst cadet, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it is truly extraordinary.
Yeah.
He's got cloned dogs.
Yeah.
One of whom is called Conan the Barbarian, and the others are named after right-wing economists. I mean, I'm not sure which is crazier. He wants to, I mean, one should point out as the backdrop to this that inflation in Argentina is 140%.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, the prelude to the Second World War shows how important inflation can be in creating populism. But what he wants to do is get rid of the Argentinian peso and replace it with the dollar, which I think is not as straightforward as he claims. But he is, you know, he is the, to me anyway, the most vivid example so far of a now a president elect who, where the clowning is the point. Mm. It's not just part of it. It's, I despise the system as much as you, the voter, do. And he's done incredibly and alarmingly well with the young, which is new, because Trump and Bolsonaro in Brazil and Boris Johnson in this country didn't.
Yeah.
So he's the first of all of these populist strongman leaders to break through the young, who just see in him a kind of frantic rebelliousness with which they can identify.
So I spent a lot of time in Argentina. I spent years working with Clarín, which is the kind of the Times
of
Argentina. So I've got a lot of Argentinian friends and have taken quite an interest in Argentinian politics. And what strikes me as interesting about Argentinian politics in particular is how there's no sensible, moderate middle ground anymore. You're split between this idea of left-wing Peronism.
Peronism, yeah.
After Juan Perón, the military general who became the president of Argentina and the husband of Eva Perón. And that sense of Peronism has become very kind of fluid, and lots of people grab it. But I remember the first time I arrived in Buenos Aires, and there was, they call them las cacerolas, the protesters with their casserole pans and their wooden spoons, marching through the streets, banging these, such a racket, cacophony of sound, amazing. See, and Buenos Aires is an amazing city, you know, like vivid and full of passion and life. And this scene of these tens of thousands of people with this, you know, these casserole dishes being hammered under the name of Peronism. But that was quite a hard left unionism, which had taken a grip of society in Argentina for a period of time under Cristina Kirchner, who was president at the time, and who sort of saw herself as the living embodiment of Eva Perón. So and that Cristina Kirchner idea, with a brief interlude from the former governor of Buenos Aires, who became president, but not very successfully, has characterized one end of the political debate in Argentina, and now we have the right-wing side of that debate, but almost its twin. And my friend, the editor of Clarín, a man called Ricardo Kirschbaum, wrote a fantastic column, I thought, where the intro of the column on the morning of the results said, "The fear of the present was greater than the fear of the future." And I think that was such a wonderful encapsulation of how populism trades on people's emotion. You know, that they're more scared of a shit situation right now than they are about what will happen in a month, 2 months, 2 years, 10 years, you know. And that's what they capsulate.
And, you know, watching, obviously with subtitles, some of his performances, he just has no guardrails. He builds himself up into a frenzy of fury, as you say, at that which is going on, which is politically empty, but it has this extraordinary emotional and power, anger, and apparently it's been effective. And the thing about all this that does alarm me and connects very much to the sort of mission of the New European and the sort of broader points we often talk about is that when Biden was elected in 2020, I remember a lot of people saying, well, that's the end of that. You know, that it's over now. We just have to wait, run out Boris, Bolsonaro, and then we can go back to nice centrist technocracy. The sort of FT Davos classes, if you like. And it just isn't true. This populism, you know, Trump was the beginning. He was a symptom as much as a cause. And here we are, we're just describing 1 week. And okay, you know, Farage in the jungle is not the beginning of the equivalent regime in the UK. Yeah. But it's significant that Farage is still around.
Well, mate, if we said, you know, even 5 years ago, that the idea that Farage could become the leader of the Tory party would be utterly laughable and absurd. And yet now he's saying never say never, you know.
Yes, and I mean, it's since we sort of first started talking about this, I've had Tory MPs say, look, you know, we don't want it to happen, but it quite easily could. There are circumstances after the next election where if he gets himself a seat, if whoever becomes the next leader tanks very quickly, he could become leader of the Conservatives relatively quickly. And one just has to be, I think, extremely vigilant and not, I mean, you can dislike these people and should, I think, but not dismissive of them because they keep winning. And, you know, one looks at France where the Le Pen family has for decades been incrementally making gains towards the presidency. And I'm not saying that, you know, they'll get there. But the assumption that because they haven't so far means that they won't ever is very dangerous, I think.
So if you pump this conversation into every living room in the land, a lot of people would be saying, well, so what? Good. You know, I like them, you know.
That's the problem. And yeah. I mean, you get to the point where, I mean, I think history has a lot to do with this and knowledge of history and time passing. Because to go back to your original use of the word fascist, I mean, it's true. The word fascist, unlike that excellent sort of Umberto Eco explanation, has become debased by overuse, especially on social media. And so the idea, you know, it happened before and it can happen again, is not really taken that seriously. So when people see, a lot of people see Trump or Suella Braverman or whoever it is, they think, you know, I don't care what the left say about them, or I don't care what progressives call them. Mm. They're talking, I feel seen. They're talking sense that I, you know, agree with. And one must be constantly sort of aware of this because, you know, nationalism is terrible, but it is, to quote Rick James, a hell of a drug. You know, you can see it all over the world, in a world that should be more interconnected, more collaborative, desperately needs international cooperation, becoming in many ways more atomized, more fragmented. And I think this is going to be a huge battle in the coming decades. It may be the battle, actually.
I went into my kids' primary school last week to talk to them about media and journalism.
Right.
9-year-olds. And 50 kids, wonderful session, you know, about an hour where they all sat there very interested in media. And I talked to them about how newspapers work and about how editors think and about how the same story would be completely differently presented on two or three separate front pages. And they asked some great questions, like, for instance, why does the Daily Mail say that, and why does the Daily Mirror say this?
Good
These
question.
9-year-old kids
Good
saying,
question.
and so we got into a conversation about the fact that about partisanship. I have to say, by the end of it, Oscar, my son, was looking at me like, "Dad, can we do some football reporting stories?
Can we roll it up?"
I left feeling that that's a conversation that should take place at schools much earlier.
Every school.
You know, that media literacy and understanding how to interpret news and to think for yourself. That's what I kept saying. I said, you can read all of these things, but you've then got to think about it.
I mean, I completely agree. And I think that schools often complain, and I understand this, that every task is put on their shoulders. But I do think preparing people for citizenship has become different.
Yeah.
You know, there aren't just 7 national newspapers and a few TV channels.
Yeah.
There is this extraordinary thing called the internet.
That's right.
And, you know, those kids, they're digital natives. They were, you know, they were born into the digital age. So they need resilience. They need to be taught resilience and critical thinking and skepticism about what they're going to encounter on their phones. And perhaps some of them already are, you know, some of them will have phones because people are getting phones younger and younger. Yeah. And I think that's absolutely fantastic what you were doing, because it's, I think that needs to be more methodically done.
Yeah.
You know, to preparing tomorrow's citizens is not just a question of saying this is how Parliament works, you know, and this is how the courts work and so on.
Yeah.
It's about how you respond to the bombardment of messages, lies, fake news, partisanship, polarisation that is just unavoidably going to be part and parcel of living in the 21st century.
I think it's got to be looked at the same way we look at sex education these days. It's like it might make you uncomfortable a little bit, it's a conversation you've got to have.
That's actually a really good analogue.
Yeah. Because none of them took out a bloody subscription, so I won't be doing it again.
Oh, I'm not sure I like that anymore. We need to do a junior subscription.
Well, to be fair, so some of them did read Oscar does gets the week junior, which we do not publish. So this is a free advert, but it is a very good way into.
Maybe we should do a TNA
the young European
young subs deal. You know,
indoctrinate your children. That would be the marketing
tomorrow,
pitch.
Be it tomorrow's anti-nationalist.
That would be the pitch.
I can see a Matt Kelly T-shirt coming on.
Yeah,
isn't it good?
Indoctrinate your children this Christmas with a subscription to the young European.
I probably find another word for indoctrinate.
Let's speak right
this,
to the market.
This Christmas, indoctrinate your children.
Into the right way of thinking.
Into the correct way of thinking.
Right, folks, if you're interested in that, you think that idea's got legs, then email me and Matt at twomatts@tnepublishing.com. And when we come back from a short break, we will be talking about...
The Autumn Statement, I think.
The Autumn Statement.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
So, welcome back, everybody. Apparently, it was a fantastic week for tax cuts, Matt.
It was a bonza week for tax cuts. We've already established that populism had a good week, unfortunately, but it was also a week of tax cuts, which is funny because I remember someone called Rishi Sunak last July saying tax cuts were fairy tale economics. But, you know, in a kind of Scooby-Doo, diddly-doo, diddly-doo moment, here we are in November 2023 and his Chancellor, Jeremy Hunt, has been giving it large on tax. Shall we have a bit of a clip of Jeremy Hunt in the Autumn Statement?
Jeremy Hunt.
In the face of global challenges, we've halved inflation, reduced our debt, and grown our economy. As a country, we're sticking to a plan that's working, and this Autumn Statement for Growth will attract £20 billion additional business investment a year in the next decade, bring tens of thousands of people into work, and support our fastest growing industries in a package which leaves borrowing lower, debts lower, and keeps inflation falling. We are delivering the biggest business tax cut in modern British history.
You know what? I saw it was the Doctor Who 60th anniversary special on Saturday. I felt this was like a sort of time travel budget or autumn statement, because it's actually a very traditionally Tory statement. You know, it's tax cuts are good, so he's lopped 2% off national insurance from January, and fiddle around with the expensing arrangement on business capital investment, which will make a difference for businesses.
Yeah.
And it's really classical Tory politics. It's retail politics. What, you know, one part of it is we like business. The other part is retail politics. We're going to cut your national insurance very quickly.
Yeah.
But it's total mirage.
Yeah. Because the tax burden is still cripplingly
The tax burden is enormous. The highest it's been since the Second World War.
Yeah.
He's making £20 billion worth of cuts to public services in effect in real terms.
Yeah.
And that is going to be felt very, very keenly by public services that are already on their knees.
Yeah.
And I suspect that actually those cuts will never be made by a Conservative government.
Yeah, it was. Well, what's weird for me, only listening to it on the radio and still trying to understand the scope of it all, it was Rachel Reeves saying, pretty much agreeing with everything he's doing.
Yeah.
You know, and also when asked by Sir Nick Robinson about...
Sir Nick de Robinson.
Did you know he supports Man United, by the way?
I have heard it said.
Yeah, multiple times a day by him.
Yes.
But when Sir Nick said... you know, are you going to be spending on public services and all of this? Basically, she was saying, well, no, we're coming out of a very tough time and that won't be happening under a Labour government, you know. So it is kind of a strange economic choice or no choice at the ballot box.
Yes, I mean, Labour is almost sort of, it's stultified, it's catatonic with terror about this because it has bad memories of, you know, Labour's tax bombshell and it's playing pretty much the playbook that Gordon Brown did up till 1997, saying, you know, we won't go any further than the Tories on spending and so on, which, of course, changed once they were in power. But there's caution and there's just mimicking. And I think that perhaps Rachel Reeves is in danger of the latter.
Yes.
Because Labour has to offer some novelty in its version of what government is all about. I mean, this is a 20th century approach to 21st century problems, right? You know, we all know the list. There's longevity, social care, the growing needs of the NHS, huge number of measures needed for climate change, infrastructure, training, pandemic resilience, technology, and the list goes on and on. We're living in an era where you're going to need more government and a lot more growth, more to the point. And they all say, yeah, we want growth. And, you know, Hunt made some measures on productivity and investments, but not enough.
Yeah.
And Labour hasn't yet spelt out how it's going to grow the economy. And, you know, I think you and I would probably immediately say, well, probably leaving the EU was not a great way of encouraging growth. And the Office of Budget Responsibility, its figures are very depressing on economic growth in the years ahead.
Yeah, and also very depressing on the idea that mortgage rates are going to stay high for much longer than people thought. That's going to become a bigger issue as more renewals come up.
I completely agree. And I think, you know, Labour is in a tight spot here because in terms of electoral popularity, they're in a good place. They have been for a while. But they're also conscious that Labour's traditional, let's say its traditional weak spot is if it appears to be incompetent with the economy.
Yeah.
And so this has become neuralgic for them. They just don't want to step a foot, a toe outside the comfort zone. And the problem is that that's going to make them sound increasingly absurd because their entry is going to involve, it is going to have to involve, you know, either public spending cuts if they stick to what Hunt announced in the autumn statement, or an admission that we're going to have to borrow more or tax more in order to spend more. And they've got to really have a route path mapped out, I think, so that they can, even if they don't spell it out before the election, they can hit the ground running on it. Because you can't have a Labour government coming in after football by then be 14 years of Tory rule just saying we're not going to spend anything.
Yeah, treading water effectively.
Yeah, I mean,
let's just see how this pans out a bit.
I mean, that is the Tory dream. The Tory dream is that Labour comes in and is kind of paralyzed with terror on spending and disappoints so immediately that in this very volatile political world we now live in, you know, before you know it, it's a one-term government.
And that is exactly, you've just articulated exactly how it feels to me, which is that it's a party that is terrified of making a mistake and is living within itself and is living under that mandate of never interrupt your enemy while they're screwing everything up. Fine. But nevertheless, at some point in the near future, touch wood, they're going to be in the hot seat. And I still say, where's the vision? Where's the idea? What do you mean?
You have to have a mission.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, our new European colleague, Alistair Campbell, you know, was extremely tough on Labour shadow ministers and not letting them step outside, you know, what had been agreed in terms of the message. But there was always, in the run-up to the 97 election, there was always a clear point to New Labour. It was going to combine social justice with economic competence. That was something you could get your head around.
Yeah.
Now, what's the equivalent for Keir Starmer? You know, what's that? What's the one line point of a Labour government?
Yeah.
Other than we're not the Tories. And they come back when you pose that question and say, you've got to understand, you know, we've gone from the worst result since 1935 in the 2019 election to the brink of office. This is different. Yeah. We just can't afford to make a mistake.
Yeah.
Okay, but at least start to hint, at least start to, you know, prepare the ground, you know, pitch rolling.
The trouble with that, as John Lennon said, is life's what happens while you're busy making other plans.
Yes.
But, you know, we should discuss briefly when you think the next election will be, whether this autumn statement is queuing up a May election or is it going to be this time next year or a little bit earlier. But if you're, something's going to happen. You know, Rishi Sunak so far behind in the polls, his only rational reason for not doing an election in May, I think, right now, is that something will happen.
Yes.
And who knows what?
Micawberism, something will turn up.
Something will happen. Yeah. Something will turn up and it'll change the dynamic. And, you know, that would be a perfectly rational observation because something does always turn up. And the trouble with Labour right now, I think, is because they're not fighting on their ground. They're sort of pointing at someone else's ground saying, look, they're on sinking sands. And it's all, you know, we're on firmer ground than them. But they're not really saying what's great about where they are and selling that vision to the nation. Trouble is, something does turn up and reverses things a little bit, then they're all mired in the same sogging ground, you know, and sinking. And nobody will have this central vision to cling to. Sunak hasn't got one. I question whether Keir Starmer's got one.
Well, you know, people are really, really angry and frustrated. And in that kind of context, you need to have more than, don't worry, we're not like the people that have generated your anger and frustration. You need to have at least the outline of an answer.
Mm.
I mean, on the election day, it's interesting because I wasn't convinced by yesterday, Wednesday, because this is Thursday, there was a lot of talk about, oh, this means a May election. And then this morning on Sky News, Jeremy Hunt said, I think it's silly to think about this in terms of the timing of the next election, which made me think, you have been thinking about the next election.
Yeah.
So why is it possible this points to a May election? Because they're putting the national insurance changes in January. And there was another poker player tell, which was in the middle of the Rwanda row last week. Rishi Sunak kept saying, I want flights in the air by the spring,
right,
which I thought was very telling.
Right.
You know, why the spring? He kept saying the spring. I think the truth is what this autumn statement does and what they're hoping for on Rwanda and won't get is that they're in a position to be ready to go in May. But I still think, to your point, Matt, that the argument is play it long.
Yeah, so they want a few solid weeks of Daily Mail front pages saying, well done, life's getting better, tax cuts, everybody's happier, and we're shipping them off to Rwanda, well played.
I mean,
they'll need that.
They won't be at all happy with the press response to the autumn statement, which has, you know, more or less been a big big raspberry.
Yeah, well, the males, I mean, the male spells it out, which was, let's hope this is just the start,
yes,
mate.
I.e., you know, if you think that's enough, you know.
We'll be back on Friday.
Can I introduce you to Mr. John Major? No, it was interesting how almost uniformly terrible the headlines were.
Yeah.
And I think that's because, I mean, I'm fascinated how little credit Biden is getting in the States for real economic success.
Yeah.
And here, there's just no translation.
Well, you wrote a really good column about the way the cord has been cut between economic success and political.
Yeah, it's the old, I mean,
congratulations.
We all say, you know, James Carville, who's Clinton's top strategist, said, he didn't say it's the economy stupid, he said the economy is stupid. But that's become a mantra in the intervening three decades, millions of headlines. And I mean, obviously the economy is always important, that it's ridiculous to claim otherwise. However, the old belief that attractive economic policy leads inexorably to electoral popularity, that's gone. You know, I think it was killed by the crash. I think it's been killed by the decline of trust. I think it's been killed by the massive growth of economic insecurity, and I keep coming back to inequality. The inequality that Western democracies are faced by today is a seriously underreported and underaddressed issue.
Well, one person who addressed it inadvertently, this is slightly disputed, but James Cleverly.
Oh yes,
yesterday, who when a Labour MP stood up and said 34%, I think it was 34%
of Stockton
constituents live in poverty. A voice, there was lots of rumbling, but a very Cleverly-esque voice could be heard muttering,
Cleverly,
that's because it's a shithole.
Which is, of course, what Trump used to say about nations that he didn't like. Yeah. So, I mean, that wasn't a great moment.
There's a story been put out since saying he didn't say that. What he said was, no, that's because you're a shit MP.
No, that's not right.
No, that's just bullshit. Any client journalist, Dan Hodges, who believes that, is talking out of his backside.
I mean, Cleverly, it's interesting because Cleverly has stormed out of the traps as Home Secretary, as claiming to be a potential next leader. I'm not quite sure why. People keep telling me he's the best communicator in the government, to which my answer is, if he's the best communicator in the government, you better shut up shop. However, it has become a thing, you know, and he is top at the moment in the Conservative Home membership survey of cabinet ministers, which is truly amazing, isn't it?
There was a wonderful, just before we shut this down, there was a wonderful tweet by Ian Dunt of The Independent.
Oh, yes.
Who,
reliably and it was funny and excellent.
It was a long telephoto lens photograph of James Cleverly on the left, David Cameron in the middle, and Rishi Sunak on the right walking towards the camera. And the height disparity between those three men was quite something to behold. And Ian Dunt tweeted, it looks like a little boy being taken to the circus by his parents.
Which in a very real sense it is,
it
I suppose.
Really, on so many levels, it felt completely
that
correct.
Ian often gets right to the point.
He's very good.
What didn't
He's
we talk good. About? This week
you went to see Napoleon.
Yes, I did, and I have to say that it's a bit of a disappointment, because it really is just a series of very wonderful cinematic battle scenes.
Yeah,
but you don't get much sense, even though the wonderful Joaquin Phoenix plays Napoleon, you don't really get much sense of why he did all these things or why he became king and emperor. And it has the feel of a video game, actually.
Right.
Which is
fascinating.
Surprising.
Fascinating. And I've become fascinated with these hats that they wear. And
I think
trying
we need,
to work
needs,
out.
Requires further investigation.
I can see a feature in the New European coming up soon. What's the story between there?
And the hats? On the subject of Napoleonic bids and so forth, the Abu Dhabi bid for the Telegraphs and the Spectator.
Yeah.
That is going to keep us very interested, I
so
think.
That's very interesting. It's led by a guy called Jeff Zucker, who was formerly the boss at CNN in the States, but left after a series of missteps and allegations of various kind of not particularly pleasant behaviour. So, that is definitely one to follow.
I mean, interestingly, the UAE is in the rankings of world press freedom, comes 145th out of 180. So that's
great.
Not very promising. I think that that's. I mean, it's interesting that Lucy Fraser, the culture secretary, has said she's minded to use that political right. word to look into it, which
right.
Tells you a lot.
Well, they'll be under a lot of pressure from the Murdoch press because Rupert still wants to buy the Spectator, doesn't he?
He does. Yeah. I'm not sure. I think this one is going to run and run. Actually,
yeah,
it's going to be a good media story. And who? I mean, it's important because you know the Telegraph has had ups and downs, but. It is still, in it, for those who care about the right, it is a prize worth having. And the Spectator is going great guns. So I can see why people would want that.
Very good. Well, thank you very much indeed for listening, folks. Please get your questions in and any feedback you might have to the twomatts@tnepublishing.com. That's the number 2 MATTS@tnepublishing.com. Or if you listen to us on Spotify, you can message us there, which is a fantastic little bit of new functionality. And that's exactly what Nigel Ingledew did, who says, perhaps you could refer to Suella as Dagenham, as in to stop short of barking. Ba-boom. Very good. Thank you for that, Nigel. We'll be back on Sunday with a new episode with our wonderful Q&A. And don't forget our Christmas deal. Head to the newEuropean.co.uk/2Matts to claim your free Christmas cards and calendar with your fantastic value subscription to the New European. Thanks as ever to the third Matt, that's producer Matt Hill at Rethink Audio, assisted by Maya Sederlund and Ollie Peart. And until next week,
it's goodbye from me.
And it's goodbye from him.
Goodbye.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.